an awful lot of music, film and telly out there. Welcome back to Big Mouth, where we try to help you navigate it all. My name's Andrew Harrison, and this week we are looking at Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, starring Frances McDormand as a woman who tries to goad an indolent police department into finding her daughter's killer. It's the new movie by In Bruges director Martin McDonagh, and it's getting fantastic notices. Is it as good as everyone's saying? And is there anything in the criticism that the movie neglects its black characters to appeal to a white audience? Plus, they were certainly the most disgusting debut of 2017, and we kind of missed them at the time. Now the debut album by Fat White Family spin-offs The Moon Landings is out again in an expanded edition, so we can catch up on it. And we'll be looking at Channel 4 young people comedies The End of the Fucking World and Derry Girls. Is there anything there for the old people? Now, who is this we? Well, it's our guests for the week, both Big Mouth regulars. Jude Rogers is a veteran of The Word magazine, which was their first proper job. In journalism at least. Unapologetic.
Nice work at the NHS.
First improper job, I think you mean.
Yes, she's working in the NHS, which is much more important. Unapologetically Welsh. She now writes for The Guardian, The New Statesman, Hole and Corner and Red magazine, as well as lecturing in journalism and writing the illustrated book Pop! With an exclamation mark, which explains pop to little kids. Hello, Jude.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
What was the most rock and roll part of working in the NHS? Back in the NHS.
Oh, gosh.
Free drugs?
There was something very rock and roll. I had to manage the case files of somebody who became a pop star.
Oh, really?
Who has talked about this in public, but I don't really want to say it now.
NHS
because of legal things.
There you go.
Yes, that was interesting, especially when 2 years later I interviewed this person. I didn't mention the person.
Oh, how are your piles then?
How are your piles?
It wasn't piles. It's something this person has talked about in detail, but really? I will not repeat. But yeah, that was very rock and roll.
So it's not lumbago or anything like that?
No.
And what was the hardest bit of pop to explain to little ones in your book called Little
Ones? Oh gosh, the most difficult bit, trying to work out how to tell kids little things about pop's history but not give them a boring dull in 1951, you know, this was released and you know, blah blah blah. So it was just about, you know, think about a 4-year-old or a 5-year-old and how they react to pop music and describe it in that way. So, you know, pop music is about shouting and jumping and doing silly things, and you can be quiet and make pop music, you can be very loud, you can do you know. So it was just trying to get into the vernacular of young kids. That was difficult when I was writing it because I was pregnant and I didn't have any children yet, so I didn't know. But my little boy is nearly 4, and he pulled it out the other day for me to read, and he is on the last page playing the drums.
Excellent.
In a pair of dungarees, age 1.
I can dimly remember.
Because by the time we finished it, he was about 1.
Yeah. I can dimly remember being like completely captured by Top of the Pops around about that age and seeing Susie Quattro doing Devil Gate Drive, and it imprinted upon me. And my nephew, he's a bit older than me, than I was at the time. He's sort of like 9, 10 now. But he has actually discovered Devil Gate Drive, but he thinks the lyrics are Down on Dribbly Drive.
Oh, brilliant.
Come alive, Down on Dribbly Drive.
I've been totally just playing Evan the music that I like. But he had a big obsession with space about 6 months ago. So I was like, right, we're going to watch Kraftwerk doing Space Lab in their latest tour. And he now thinks Kraftwerk work in the International Space Station.
They do, don't they?
Yeah.
Devil Gate Drive was on the BBC's. They had a kind of a glam compilation on the other weekend. Have you seen this clip where they're doing the song, and when they do the chorus, Susie Quattro and the guitarist do a special kind of leg kicking dance? The drummer comes out from behind his drum kit. Drums are obviously still playing on the song, and joins in, and so does the pianist who's doing the riff. It's just like,
so we all knew it was theatre.
I know, but it's not even attempting. And the dance is rubbish.
I was distracted by Susie Quattro in a outfit. Anyway, moving on. Also with us, keeping up levels of Welshness in name, if not actually by nature, it's Sian Pattenden, who is a graduate of the Smash Hit School for Gifted Youngsters. She has also had a go at explaining the music world to young people in book form, and she now runs the on-off Guerrilla Pop Art Emporium, GRRR, with several R's, where she sells bespoke hand-painted Throbbing Gristle mugs, Gillian Gilbert from New Order badges, and which Jude has got, and she's going to be putting on in a second, and, of course, most importantly, anti-Brexit art biscuits. Hello, Sian, how are you?
Hello, I'm fine, thank you.
Now, your lad's a bit older than Jude's, a fair bit older.
He's 12 and a half, and he has no track with pop music.
Really? Now,
just
why
likes
is this?
The Pixies and Nirvana. Anything. Yeah, I mean, it's the pop stuff. Lady Gaga, I always thought was awful when everybody in the class liked it. And he'll sort of listen to my music and then just go, no, it's too much. Please, no.
Your music, what do you mean?
Anything that I put on. Anything. I mean, you know, really, it was,
it runs out the room if you put Saint Etienne on.
Yeah. He would run out of the room if I put anything but Pixies and Nirvana on at the moment.
But it's the law that your children should have.
Oh, yes, and absolutely, yes, he should. And he should get into something completely despicable. He should get into something, something quite preppy, because I wouldn't like that.
Some yacht rock.
Get into cricket or something. Yeah.
What exciting new product lines does your shop Gurr, which is kind of, it is Warholian.
Well, it's raw art. Gurr is really, if we're talking about, how the branding works. Gurr is part of raw art. I am raw art, but Gurr is me and my friend Pandora. Raw art is the thing that keeps rolling on, and I sell art through the website. I sold the Big Jimmy painting. I was really pleased, which is the inside of Electric Ladyland painted. You know, the ladies of the night. So I've done a series of those because it reminds me of Déjeuner sur l'Herbe.
Right.
By Molly. Yeah. And about the female
with
gaze.
With a lot more
and
nude
about,
ladies.
Yeah, about your muse, and it's about other ladies staring back at you. Yeah. I kind of was dealing with things like
it's
that.
Amazing.
And rock and roll. And all sorts of things. So I'm going to be doing more work in oils, she said.
More work in oils.
Potentially. for this year.
Because we're actually all about, we're more about the merch, and particularly the Throbbing Gristle type mugs. What exciting product lines have you got coming up?
I can't tell you. It's January. I told you this is when I tinker with the HTML and do the website and do the hosting. The art stuff goes from February onwards. I have a plan.
I've put in a request for the David Bowie Low mugs because I wanted to get one and they've sold out because they're too popular.
They do sell out.
There you go. Yeah. Well, also with us, as usual, you just heard him there creating radically different recording methods in a freezing cold dungeon somewhere in London. It is our innovative producer, Genesis P. Oddcast himself, Matt Hall. Hello, Matt. How you doing?
Until then, that was fine.
Yeah. What's your personal favourite objet d'art from the world of music?
My personal favourite is when I started at Radio 1, I moved into an office that was vacated by a producer who'd left, who'd been there for ages, and on the windowsill was a promotional item which came from a record that I was obsessed with, I'm still slightly obsessed with, Reckless Eric's Big Smash. And the promotional item is a house brick with a kind of bit of felt stuck on the bottom and the Big Smash logo painted down the side, and I still have it.
Oh, wow. Useful paperweight.
Yeah. Kind of, it's the kind of thing that my wife rolls her eyes at every time we move house and this bloody brick follows.
unerringly. It puts my Deuce sponge bag to shame.
Deuce.
Do you remember them? She's just split up with Ant McPartlin, one of Deuce.
It might be worth putting it on eBay.
Maybe I shall.
While the market's hot.
Well, my favourite is now, has to be consigned to a nuclear, a kind of chemical waste dump. It was the Earl Brutus cream of mushroom soup. Which after 10 years of sitting on the shelf, this was gifted to me by former guest on the show, Mark Wood. After like 20 years of sitting on the shelf, it started to go convex at either end and was clearly about to mutate and explode. Yes. So we had to get rid of somewhere in a landfill site in the southeast of London, this biochemical warfare thing.
Have you not heard it go slowly?
It's going to do
as
that.
As Crystal Palace rises kind of 5 inches.
Yeah. All right, let's crack on. I mentioned it earlier. Martin McDonagh's Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri is the movie of the moment. Much like In Bruges, it's a taut but often very funny character movie in which awful things happen, human lives are marked forever, and black comedy isn't an escape, but it's intrinsic to the world the characters inhabit. What do we make of it? Well, we're going to have a taster and then talk about it.
Hey, you. What the hell is this?
Advertising, I guess.
I could arrest you right now if I wanted to.
Before you do that, how about you go have yourself a look at that first billboard over there?
So, Mildred Hayes, why did you put up these billboards?
My daughter Angela was murdered 7 months ago. It seems to me the police department is too busy torturing black folks and eating Krispy Kremes to solve actual crime.
Dixon, I'm in the middle of my goddamn Easter dinner. Sorry, kids.
I know, Chief, but I think we got kind of a problem. Sunshine
beating on a good time. I'd do anything to catch your daughter's killer.
I don't think those billboards is very fair.
The time it took you to get out here whining like a bitch, Willoughby. Some other poor girl's probably out there being butchered right now.
The more you keep a case in the public eye, the better your chances are getting it solved. And when I
see the sign. What's happening with the billboard lady?
She's tough as an old boot, mama.
All this anger, man. It just begets greater anger.
In 3, 2, 1. And as sad as the spectacle of these billboards might be,
go, girl.
This reporter, for one, hopes this finally puts an end to the strange saga of the three billboards outside.
This doesn't put an end to anything. This is just a start. Why don't you put that on your Good Morning Missouri wake-up broadcast, bitch?
A taster of Martin McDonagh's Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. Jude Rogers. Set it up for us. What's happening here?
Okay, so Frances McDormand plays a mum whose teenage daughter has been raped and murdered. That's not a spoiler. It's on the billboards. Yeah. It's 7 months ago. Nothing's happened with the police investigation. So she decides to pay for three billboards on a kind of country road that nobody really goes on outside Ebbing, Missouri, and put some messages on it. One of them directing, but pointing the finger at the local head of police.
But not as the murderer.
For not doing enough to find out who the murderer is. Why haven't you done anything? And then obviously the TV crews come along, people start to notice it, and things start kicking off in the town. It's got Woody Harrelson plays the kind of the head of the police. We've got Sam Rockwell as a not particularly bright, pretty racist cop who people know as having tortured black people. This is what's talked about in the film. And lots of other great supporting actors, including Peter Dinklage, is that his name? From Game of Thrones, with an amazing haircut and moustache, who plays a small but pivotal role in the film. And it's basically the effects of what happens once these billboards have come up. It's a film about anger, I think.
Yeah.
It's about what happens when something awful happens and how you direct that anger. And it's interesting because you think it's going to be, well, personally, I thought it's going to be one kind of film. It's, a bit Coen Brothers. It's got, the kind of visual cues, beautiful landscapes. It's quite dark. The comedy is, there's lots of comedy in it, which is sharp and very funny. And which takes you unaware sometimes.
You kind of think you're on rails into a whodunit here, don't you?
Yeah.
And without, we'll try to avoid spoilers as much as humanly possible, you very much go in a different direction.
Mm. Yeah.
Sian, did you enjoy it?
I loved it. I thought it was great. And as you say, I was going to say, it sets it up like a whodunit. You think, okay, we're going to have a handful of characters and I've got to guess which one, and I've got to keep guessing which one. But it just explores something different. It explores the reaction of a town and the town as a character itself and how people just live and work in that. There were a couple of things where I thought, oh, that's an about turn of character. Yeah. Can't mention which because that's a bit of a spoiler, but suddenly you're actually all right underneath it all.
But I found that actually really plausible because, I enjoyed the fact that I thought the characters were plausibly and kind of winningly inconsistent the way actual human beings
are.
And we can probably talk about this in a minute. There's been a kind of a social media backlash against it. Let's concentrate on the thing itself. Jude, I mean, did you enjoy it?
There were some points I was thinking, oh, I can see where this is going. This is going to take a slightly twee turn, and there's going to be a moral at the end of this, and then it would go woof and go in the other direction.
Yeah.
There's something that happens about 45 minutes in, which is very dramatic, and I did not expect that then has an impact on all the characters in a different way, and there's lots of dramatic scenes that happen. I can't say too much without spoilers, but people are thrown out of things.
You were talking about the Coen. You mentioned the Coen brothers, and it was. I did think, it's not only because Frances McDormand heavily pregnant in Fargo. It's kind of like it's a bit like Fargo in the summertime. Everybody's slightly kooky. Mm. The guy who sells, the advertising man who's responsible for the billboards.
But it takes it down a level, doesn't it?
Yeah, it turns it down a little bit, but it also keeps you, they're not just caricatures. They're real people.
Woody Harrelson is amazing.
Yeah.
And Sam Rockwell, I thought he was fantastic. Because 5 minutes, 10 minutes, it took me to think, oh, it's Sam Rockwell.
Yeah, me too. And I adore
who
him.
He is. Yeah. It's just like, you're quite good at acting, aren't you?
I was obsessed with him when he was in Moon.
Yes, he's fantastic, and I would say he's amazing.
I think Matt's right there in that, like, you, in a film like this, because we've all got movie grammar inside our heads, and we all think we know what to expect. And what this is really about is taking characters you expect to be caricatures and unpacking them.
Yeah.
They're no longer caricatures. Mm. You're no longer watching the whodunit you think you're watching. Neither are you watching the, down home, small town, everybody pulls together movie that you think you might expect.
Mm.
And you follow the story of, the three core characters are Woody Harrelson's cop, Frances McDormand as the mom, as Mildred, and Sam Rockwell. And,
Dixon.
It's almost impossible to talk about their, quote, journeys without spoiling this movie because they are the payoff.
But there are journeys I think that the supporting actors, like, there's some beautiful bits of Frances of Mildred and her son, the kind of who swearing at each other like sailors on shore leave, but still obviously love each other and the kind of. And then there's the amazing bit, which is still the bit that makes me laugh out loud when I think about it, when she drops him off at school and there's some, let's just say, interaction with some of his school colleagues.
The best, my favourite scene is when she, the vicar comes around the house to kind of tell her, you know, actually, Mildred, you should be doing this, you shouldn't be putting these billboards up. And she basically tears him into one. But it's just brilliant. Even the kind of minor characters on caricatures, they're all filled in.
Well, let's go into those criticisms now, because it's been said that the film has a big hole in it, which is that the black characters don't get filled in at all. Sean, you're about to hop in here.
I was going to hop in. I didn't mind that so much because you don't want tokenism either. Mm. And maybe it's a film about those main characters and maybe then sort of trying to get supporting actors to be something that they're not. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know how you can shoehorn something in. What I was going to say is there are two female characters that I, if you're going to get picky, was slightly uncomfortable with, which is the girlfriend of her ex-husband.
The ex-husband's girlfriend.
Who's so stupid.
But has a heart of gold.
But also so funny as well. She's really.
Do I want to see that? Do I care? Couldn't she have said something else about the bookmark? You know.
But isn't that the reality of this world, which is you are going to meet a wide variety of people, none of whom is going to conform to your expectations.
Coincidentally, there's a really stupid woman who works with the man who does the advertising hall. Hoardings.
She wasn't stupid.
She is really stupid. That scene. Yeah, she's not right.
Kind of
so two's
dizzy,
a bit of a coincidence. Yeah, too ditzy. We go, can we have something else?
But on the other hand, Woody Harrelson's wife is, I think,
with quite a limited
minutes of screen time.
And a very wandering accent has to be.
I thought she was British. There was an awful lot of British accents in there. Anyway.
Yeah. I did have a little problem with the ditziness.
But the criticism is that.
The black characters.
The criticism is that the role the black characters play in this is one of them gets tortured by a cop and we never really find out what happened there. Somebody else is arrested on trumped up charges in order to get at Mildred, and then miraculously later in the film she kind of gets out and nothing more is said. And then there's a black cop who appears later in a way we can't really say anything without spoiling it. But that these are not.
But he's really good.
He's not Detective Inspector
or who's they're going to be in charge of the police. He's brilliant. And he comes in, he's Mr. Integrity, and he brings integrity to that police station. And suddenly those characters are going, hang on.
Yeah.
And also,
180-degree turns in character.
There's a big switch, which one of the black characters you see at the beginning, but is very incidental, is a kind of fulcrum on which everything turns at one point. Mm. So
I'm agreeing with you. I was annoyed with this kind of this sort of off the peg attack on the film, as if all you can ever do with any work of art now is kind of get out your diversity slide rule and say it doesn't measure up here. Mm. You know, the complaint is that Dixon, the racist cop played by Sam Rockwell, doesn't get his come
up. This is what I was going to say, yeah.
And yet he kind of does.
Yeah, he
kind
of does.
This is not the kind of movie.
I think he gets a quite permanent come up.
But what he doesn't get is, quote, movie justice.
He gets redemption, maybe.
Well, yeah, or does he?
We don't know, yeah.
This is not the kind of film where people get a pat redemption.
Could I just mention again my favourite cinema, The View, Finchley Road, which I hate? Could you not sit me next to the woman who doesn't understand it and is asking the gentleman that she is with to explain the plot to her for an hour and a half all the way through? Thank you very much. I'm just going to say,
well, there's a reason it only cost a fiver.
This is what we call a director's commentary, Jude.
Yeah. Your comment about this diversity slide, Drew. Yeah, it's uncomfortable when you're thinking, okay, we're four white people on a table talking about this. But what I hated about the main piece about this backlash was there are white characters racist who don't get their comeuppance. Films are not there to deliver moral lessons. They are there to ask questions and explore things. And there are a lot of white racist people out there. I'm sorry, not all. And sadly, they should get a comeuppance, but they don't. And I've seen this moving, this coming up more and more in criticism, you know, that people kind of almost look at everything and assess it and think, okay, this isn't...
This
isn't moral. This isn't, you know, kind of ticking all these boxes. And I think that's incredibly dangerous.
It's reductive,
It's reductive. I mentioned the backlash to my other half, and he was saying this is not a film, you know, films aren't for kids, you know, kind of they tell you about the world, and it is, and, you know, this is a world that is not
However,
easy is complicated.
I do have a serious diversity issue with Three Billboards, which is its portrayal of a comics fan is disgraceful. Dixon, the racist cop. However, I then realised it's not disgraceful at all. It's brilliant because if you're a real nitpicking nerd like me, you'll spot that he's got a T-shirt and he's reading a copy of the great comic Incorruptible by Mark Waid. Now, the quick recap on this is Mark Waid wrote a fantastic series called Irredeemable, and the high concept on it is Superman goes insane and destroys the world. Right, it's awesome. Superman is out of control, and all of the kind of second string superheroes are trying to rein him in, and they can't. Mm-hmm. It's a brilliant, brilliant series. It went so well that he did a spin off called Incorruptible, in which basically the worst supervillain in the world is so horrified by what bad Superman is doing that he turns good. Right. He turns good.
Okay.
Brilliant,
okay.
Simple, so great conceit would make an amazing movie. But the idea that the sort of ostensible villain of the piece, he's not even a thinking villain, he's kind of a thoughtless thug, but he's wearing this emblem of how the worst guy in the world can turn, can redeem himself.
I thought that was a nice
little note.
Well, it's Martin McDonagh, who is really good, and in Bruges is great, and also shows the grey.
He does,
grey, you're a mercenary and you shoot people for a living, but actually that's what he's there for, and I love that, and I love the ending. I just thought, yes, so just to say, I love that ending.
Mm. So by and large, fantastic. We're all saying
I really liked it.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a great
controversially
film.
We loved it. All right, let's crack on with a bit of music. We ask all of our guests to bring a tune in, their personal editor's recommendation in the Britannia Music Club, that is Big Mouth. Jude Rogers, what have you got for us?
This is MAH, Mad as Hell by US Girls. US Girls is one woman, Megan Remy, who's released quite a few records already, which is sort of, it's experimental, slightly strange, you know, pop. Bit like St. Vincent's kind of trajectory is kind of, she's been getting more poppy and more mainstream. This album is fantastic. She basically, about 2 years ago, decided to make an album about this thing that all her friends were talking about, which was a lot of the stuff that's basically come up in the Me Too campaigns recently. And it's basically about her giving it to blokes who've been awful to her, which, you know, doing that in a pop record, you think, oh, is that going to work? It works amazingly. The lyrics are shocking and mad and angry in a lot of the times, but it's delivered through some pop music that is like disco and funk and all. It's pop music completely that you can dance to, but with serious subject. But it doesn't. It's not worthy. It's not, doesn't lay it down with the trowel. It's fantastic. And this was a single, the first single from the record released just before Christmas, and the album's coming out next month, and it's amazing.
What's the album called?
It's called A Poem Interrupted or something like that, which is, no, Poem Unlimited, right, which is not a good title for the album. Okay. But it's got this amazing cover of a picture of her, a kind of like 60s picture of her, kind of slightly crying, this girl group stuff through it. There's girl group stuff on this record
okay.
as well. It's
well,
great.
Listen up, blokes. This is MAH.
Blokes should love it.
Blokes
love this.
Yeah, MAH, Mad as Hell
and
by
ladies.
You and ladies.
Ladies too, if you like, yeah.
MAH, Mad as Hell by US Girls. That's the woke Kylie sounds of US Girls with MAH Mad as Hell as chosen by heavily woke Jude Rogers. And sticking with music, the best bands are made up fantasies in somebody's head, but they don't always make it out into the real world. The Moon Landings were the fictional band on the Excentronic Research Council's debut album back in 2012. They were supposed to be, quotes, a cosmic krautabilly group wearing lederhosen and tinfoil socks. Two fat white family helped the Excentronics to bring the Moon Landings to life, and then they made an actual album, Interplanetary Class Classics, with guest spots from Phil Oakey, Yoko Ono and Sean Lennon. The Moon Landings became a bigger deal than either of those bands that birthed them, and now the album is out in the traditional expanded edition. We're going to talk about it after this taster, one of the few broadcastable bits of this album. This is This City's Undone, open brackets, Confidence Man Cool Party Remix, close brackets, featuring Phil Oakey and Yoko Ono.
People.
The Confidence Man remix of This City's Undone by the Moonlandings from the expanded edition of Interplanetary Club Classics, which is out on the 26th of January. Now, that was very disco and considerably less disgusting than the rest of their stuff. Sean Pattenden, what do you make of the Moonlandings?
I'm still slightly divided. I quite like them. I really like the Flat...
The Flat White Family, yeah, famous coffee shop.
It's such a coffee chain name, yes. Isn't it? Flat White Family, they have their one song. That's the hit.
Playing their song again.
Any other songs. And I always think, please, could you just write some songs? Just write some hits. This would be fantastic. And I think this is the attempt to write the hits, isn't it? Mm. There are elements of it I really like, but it's... Does anyone remember Grebo?
I'm
feeling a Grebo feeling from this.
I'm feeling
they haven't washed for a really long time.
That's definitely true.
They've imbibed all sorts of substances we don't even know the names for. We're talking debauchery, we're talking hedonism. Mm. Haven't seen them live, which is probably the big thing.
That'll
if I'd seen them live, I would. It would all come together. I think I need to do that. So the elements about it I really like, but there's elements which just make me think of
it's just because you've got gay bikers on acid in your head hiding.
Yeah, they sit there and they have this alarm when
I thought
I went to my national childbirth classes with Mary from Gay Bikers on Essex.
There we go.
I don't know where to go with that one.
Yes,
there is.
Virgin
I mean,
Mary.
There is a weird Sheffield undercurrent here because one of them, the Excentronic Research Council, one of them was in the All Seeing Eye of And the Beat Goes On fame, and also of the First Man in Space with Phil Oakey.
Oh, yeah.
Dean Ahona from the band was in Eye Monster of Daydreaming Blue fame. Remember that baby? I fell asleep among the flowers.
Yeah.
And there's a certain kind of, there's a sort of seedy glam space electronics, Fat Truckers. You know, remember Fat Truckers? Teenage Daughter. All that.
You're very good at this.
Very, very, very horrible Sheffieldness going on, which
yes.
I really, really like.
I was going to say, it's Keith Harrison.
Well, it's like a kind of David Lynch Phoenix Nights type of thing that they've got going on, which I love and I'm totally swept away by. June, did you like it?
Yeah, I did actually. I don't think the album, you know, could have... Sometimes you think, oh, get on with it. You know, you're listening to a deluxe edition, which has lots of remixes and extracts at the end. But I really enjoyed it. It took me a while to get into it. But I love David Lynch, Phoenix Nights is absolutely it. I keep thinking of, you know, Frankenfurter from Rocky Horror. If he's wandered into,
into your local Labour Club.
Yeah,
basically.
Ran more and gone, all right, you know, and kind of started kicking off.
And some of their videos reflect that. He walks down the street in the glam rock clothes.
Yeah.
Elias. Is it pronounced like that? And he's got a cob piece on and his makeup all...
Right. The video for Strangle of Anna, God knows what that song's about.
Ooh, that's great.
He's naked from the waist up, wearing two fried eggs stuck around him in... cling film as a bra.
And there's another video where he's trying to shave with a trunk of a tree on the moor side. That's really good. And he's bleeding.
Are we saying it's a searing in kind of dissection of masculinity? Or is it just people being disgusting?
They're having
fun.
A laugh.
Yeah.
I think so. That's the problem is sometimes I think, well, it's your in-joke. And I'm not sure that I feel part of your in-joke.
Right.
This is obviously hilarious. Sean Lennon's on bongos, you know, all that sort of thing. Yoko Ono's doing amazing stuff in the background of City Undone there. And yet, I don't really feel that part of it. And you've got to have the audience feel part of it.
I just remember David Devont and his spirit wife.
Oh,
yeah. Just come into my head. They used to remember on stage, they used to shave carrots onto like a mannequin's head and stuff like that. It's got that kind of thing about it.
Yeah.
But it's just when I first got the record, you just look down the list of track names and you go, thank God, there's something, you know, it's great. And well, on the deluxe edition, Drop It Fauntleroy or something?
Yeah.
There's
these
titles, like, thank God somebody's doing... You know, having that element of fun, kind of ridiculousness,
but also reaching into their own kind of their own seedy psyche. I mean, without getting too graphic about it, there's quite a lot about the male body and its properties.
Yeah. Some references to holes, aren't there?
There's all sorts of things.
Family show, Sean.
There's
massive.
A glory hole is a corner of a house,
filthy.
Right?
But it's quite biological.
Yeah,
it's quite biological.
It certainly is.
I couldn't get to grips with this record at all. I did find that. When I first put it on, I was like, oh, great. This is kind of like, this sounds a bit like The Cramps. This sounds a little bit kind of rock, you know, that kind of punk rock, rockabilly stuff.
It's definitely more Alvin Stardust than Ziggy Stardust.
Yeah, but the Cramps dealt with a lot, and Lux Interior dealt with a lot of the same kind of lyrical concerns, but did it with a lot more kind of tongue-in-cheek humour that meant that you could cope with a kind of a bloke in a G-string and high heels with a bouffant hairdo and nothing else singing about the crusher and, you know, being the human fly and stuff. But this kind of is a little bit... I think it tries a little bit too hard.
Well, I think the thing that makes it really appealing is that it's not a joke. it's not like what,
well, then they should not, get some therapy.
They're not doing it for a laugh. I think they what they really want
is therapy.
They want to make something genuinely different, and it is. Although we've just listed all the things whose lineage it's in, and we haven't even mentioned Earl Brutus and Joe and Peter Kay, and you know everything that you could possibly throw into this blender. Actually, probably less.
Peter Kay's lawyers are just—they're on the phone now.
Probably a bit. Peter Kay
was a bit Marky Smith and some of those titles and things I thought were there.
But it still kind of comes out.
Yeah, it's not
sort of unique to me. Yeah,
and you just think for that, please.
Well, that's a pretty low bar, though, isn't it? Really.
Oh, we can just set that bar low. Can we keep on with that?
I mean, to me, I think they're you know, same Fat White Family. They've only got one song. I think these are actually way better than Fat White Family.
I do
because
I do.
It's musically ambitious and it's strange and it's disgusting and kind of bespattered with all kinds of detritus.
I do want to see them live, even if they do poo on stage. That's me. I'm there in the front. Well, maybe not the front, maybe in the middle. But I think that's the next step.
In a raincoat.
Get the joke.
They are
in a raincoat.
Yes. Some friends of mine saw them live before Christmas, and they said they were fantastic.
Yeah,
Would we listen to this record for fun?
I have been. Tell you what, walking through Soho this morning, remembering old Soho.
Yeah.
It was quite interesting, kind of going, yeah, come on. Oh, that's turned into a pret.
I was in the tube and we got stuck in a tunnel for a while, and I had it on the headphones really, really loudly, and it helped enormously. Otherwise, I would have had a massive panic attack. So
there you go.
It does help, yeah.
So art is therapy then. Fantastic. We've established
that. For the sticker in the front of the album.
Shall we do some telly then?
Yeah.
The end of the fucking world is an everyday story of a teenage psychopath and the girl
Sorry,
who loves...
We've just told Sharm not to be because it's a family show.
Anyway. The End of the Fucking World is an everyday story of a teenage psychopath and the girl he loves and keeps trying to murder. We missed it on Channel 4 last year, but it's just gone up on Netflix and the whole world has fallen in love with it. Derry Girls, on the other hand, is the everyday story of Catholic schoolgirls in Northern Ireland at the height of the Troubles. What can these shows tell us about the young people? Are they funny? And do we care about the young people? Here's a bit of both of them.
I'm James. I'm 17. And I'm pretty sure I'm a psychopath. Hey.
I'm not saying he's the answer. Hey. But he's something.
I thought she could be interesting to kill.
Are you waiting for me?
So I pretended to fall in love with her.
I feel comfortable with him. Sort of safe. I'm serious. Let's leave this town now. Let's get out of here. Yeah!
Police, please.
We should do the washing up.
Will the following pupils please report to Sister Michael's office? Erin Quinn, Claire Devlin, Michelle Mallon, Orla McCool, and the wee English fella.
Will we get expelled?
Nobody ever actually gets expelled. Rhonda Gallagher hasn't even been expelled and she's in ARA. I'd
say that's probably why.
Don't worry yourselves too much about the whole sectarian conflict carry on. There's really only one thing you need to know. We're the goodies.
Call me Peter.
Is that a firm hole gel you're using?
It's a moose.
Christ.
What are they?
Golf clubs.
I thought spatulas?
They're rifles!
A bit of The End of the Fucking World and a bit of Derry Girls. Now, should we do The End of the Fucking World first? I loved this. I loved it. I thoroughly enjoyed it. Sean, you didn't.
I hated it. I lasted 10 minutes. And then I tried to put it on again. And then I hated it. Unfortunately, I was watching it with my 12-and-a-half-year-old son. Oh, that's not it. Don't watch it with your 12-and-a-half-year-old son because it's really rude.
What was it you disliked about it so much?
I thought it wasn't thought out properly. My problem was the two main characters are misanthropists. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing to balance it. Steve Oram plays a dad, and I love Steve Oram. He's done some brilliant films as well. And he's kind of nice guy. I say, I got about 15 minutes in. I couldn't bear that both of them had to have this worldview and had to be so alienated. I didn't believe in her at all. I thought that we're just going shade for the sake of it. I thought it was tokenistic in that way. There wasn't any balance. Let's go dark, because this is like really cutting edge. And I just thought, it's just not... And it's young people. I'm not young anymore.
But if
I don't care if they're snogging, please, because I'm not watching
that.
Snog.
Let me... If you only got 15 minutes in, as the thing progresses, it does debunk that, and it shows you that beneath that sort of... Yeah, intensely annoying teenage there are interesting things and quite a lot of sort of complexity. And
I was Sean. And then I thought, right, I'll watch another one just in case. And then it started to turn a bit. Mm. And I've watched six of them now. And I'm annoyed that I'm not going to be able to see the rest of them because my mother-in-law's staying for a couple of days. But yeah, at the start I thought, oh, here we go, cliches. It's got the kind of Tarantino sort of swampy blues girl group stuff. You know, they're supposed to be Bonnie and Clyde, but she's really annoying,
she's
and
really
he's like
annoying
some
at
this
first.
Terrible cliche of a kind of, you know, it reminded me of the film Submarine.
Yes, very much. It's in
you know,
that
in
school.
Tone and stuff like that. Yeah. And which is very stylized. And I thought, basically, this has been done before and there's nothing new here. But as it moves along, you start to find out why he's like that. You start to find out what happened to his mother.
Yeah. And why she's like that. Yeah.
Their kind of teenage sort of front, you know, the bravado starts to peel away with her and different things start happening. And yeah, it took me a while because I'm thinking, I don't like this. Now I really like it. But it's a shame that it takes a while in some
Although,
ways.
To be fair, I mean, it's like 20 minutes an episode.
That's true.
This is the length of a moderate...
I like
the whole
that,
series is the length
actually.
Of a moderate
we've
girl
all,
movie.
We've all got busy lives.
You have to
I mean, you've got to fit it in when you
true,
can.
Yeah.
But you know, when they get... You didn't get to the professor's house.
No. I just thought, oh, please. And they're so young. I mean, they're probably played by 30-year-olds. But I feel uncomfortable watching young people do the young people thing. It makes me feel a bit weird. You know, it's not speaking to me. It's not aimed at me, that programme. It's aimed at people who've got money to buy trainers and things like
that. I had the same situation as you, though. I started watching it and then my daughter walked through and I said, oh, this is really good.
And
then,
that may have
and then it was kind of like, okay. Yeah. I've got one episode left to go and I absolutely think it's brilliant. And I think that, as Jude says, the characters who appear just really snotty and teenage and shallow and self-obsessed at the beginning, as the series goes on, you find out the reasons for their kind of behaviour. And there's some lovely characterisation with a pair of police women who are investigating
they're brilliant.
What's going on.
She's on Game of Thrones, isn't she?
She is, yeah. There's some great kind of ancillary characters. Lynn from Alan Partridge pops up running a garage.
Oh, I haven't seen her yet.
At one point, which is very funny. And I really liked it. I was going to ask you, apparently it's based on a comic. Which I haven't read.
Oh,
I don't know.
I didn't know.
Yeah, by Charles Forceman.
Oh,
Charles
right.
S. Forceman. I really like the fact that it's a British kind of road movie.
Doesn't feel very British, though, does it?
Because no, but
we were talking about
I
how all the
that.
Locations are quite weird because the houses aren't very British. The only place that feels slightly British is this American diner they're in quite early on.
Yeah.
And the houses opposite look like British council
but
houses.
But I quite like that.
That's about it.
Because it's generic suburbia. It's a little bit ghost world.
Yeah.
It's a little bit nowhere's
real. Very ghost world.
And it reminded me of those movies that came out of America in the kind of mid-90s where they were all set in generic towns and there's lots of walking through streets where everything's the same and people, characters just walk and then they just have a random interaction.
I guess
with
that's why it feels a bit crap,
again.
First of all, because all these cliches and feel shallow.
I went back and watched Harold and Maude, which I thought it's got so much from Harold and Maude here, and to see how the balance between, because Maude is so positive and you have this, you know, you have Harold, who's trying to chop off his arms and he hangs himself and he sets himself on fire in
Spoiler
front of
alert.
People. That he's always so old.
It's from the 70s.
Yeah.
He's always killing
his
himself.
His mum is trying to marry him off to. And then there's Maude, who's nearly 80 and is just loves life and looks at daisies and dances around and hangs around at funerals.
Yes.
And that sort of thing. And I was looking at but that to me was the balance and that is set up very early on. And the problem, there was no balance for me early on enough for me to watch it.
Do you think maybe it's because if this was presented to you in the form of, like I say, it's like 8 episodes at 20 minutes each. So that's a long movie. If it's presented to you in the form of a movie, you'd absolutely hoover it up.
Yeah, maybe.
And in episodic... It's interesting, actually, Matt, because I didn't realise it was adapted from a comic, because it has a very comic book sensibility in that the scenes are short and quite static and they juxtapose kind of radically against each other.
Yeah, and you get random things happening, which you kind of think... That's just totally logical, but you know, characters bump into each other completely. But actually, if it's coming from a kind of comic world, that makes a little more sense.
It struck me as like, you know, those kind of infuriatingly annoying kind of millennial adverts with the ukulele about a dating app or how to, you know, order flowers kind of thing. If you took that and you subtracted every atom of sentimentality out of it and every atom of fake emotion and left the kind of the truth of blank effectlessness in there, you'd have this show.
Yeah.
An appealing idea, I think.
Instagrammable.
And there is a reason.
Bleak Instagram.
And there is a reason as it goes on for the title. It's not the nihilistic title that you... Well, there's another connotation to the title that makes more sense as you go on.
We're just talking about how this thing has no sense of place. It feels like it's nowhere. It could be middle America. It could be the southeast of England. It could be suburban anywhere. Derry Girls is all about sense of place, isn't it? Derry Girls, Londonderry. You know, it's the story of, you know, Catholic schoolgirls in the middle of the Troubles, and What did we make of this? Now, this is an ensemble female show.
I loved it. Yeah. I thought it was brilliant. I mean, for the moment, it started. That's real life. That's what it was like being at school, apart from I had less friends in another group.
And not as many bombs going off, yeah.
But that's so funny. And I shared a flat and still are very good friends with two girls from Northern Ireland. And they talk about it like that. Oh, bloody hell, it's another, you know, bomb going off.
There's and a great line at the start.
I was going to the shops, you know, go to Topshop.
The answer in the first episode is, I don't know about you, I'm not enjoying this bomb.
Yes, it's fantastic. And
also,
some of
Uncle Colm in the second episode, who is the most boring man in the six counties, I think, who makes being tied up by some terrorists and having his van nicked tells the story, and they're all just going, please end it now. This is really dull.
Yeah.
It's got nuns in it. It's got schoolgirls. They all speak in that Northern Irish vernacular. Mm. Those keywords that they use are just so fantastic that my flatmates used to use. I really liked it. That normalcy, and then you've got the bombs, and then you've got the nuns, and then you've got them having to bond, boys, diary, and then the geeky boy who's English, and they make so many jokes about the English. I just thought that was brilliant.
So it's an all girls school, really, and the English boy's been sent there because if he goes to a mixed school, he'll get kneecapped.
Because he's English.
Yeah.
So he's in a Catholic school, surrounded by all these nuns and all these girls, and he can't go to the toilet in the first episode, which is really good.
I love the nun. I think it's the beginning of the second episode where there's this a cappella girls' choir and they're singing Love Is All Around, and the nun goes, I thought this was on the band list. And they've got this list of band songs, which are basically all the popular songs of like 92.
Which have love in the title.
Knock this one out as well. Yeah,
It really reminded me, can I just say, of The Sopranos. Not that Sopranos,
the
but Alan Warner's Sopranos, which is a novel that came out in 1998, I think, and which equally has that kind of female group of friends, unfiltered, being themselves.
Do you know what it reminded me of? It's got that kind of Gavin and Stacey feel about it, because it's kind of in terms of the tone of it, because it feels very mainstream in some respects, but they get away with lots of actually quite dark stuff thrown into the mix. You know, Gavin and Stacey got away with, Nessa saying lots of incredibly rude things, you know, and you watch it now and you go, oh, gosh, and Uncle Bryn made me, you know, the kind of Colm character. But yeah, it was fantastic. And the way it kind of absolutely encapsulates being, I'm the same age as those characters, so kind of being in your early to mid-teens in the early 90s with the pop culture references are spot on and not overlaid. It's just...
Also, I think
I felt it was about, you know, I could have been one of those Googles with a slight difference that Wales didn't have.
You need to push the Welsh version then. Campaign. You know, it's just you can just spin it off the Welsh version.
The set designers also deserve a medal, because having been to kind of Derry a few times over the last few years, the fact that they've managed to find bits that look like they've not been redeveloped and had massive amounts of money pumped into them. Actually. And there's the Peace Bridge, and there's
the
whole
kitchen as well.
Yeah,
Mum's kitchen is so like a kitchen of that
and
time.
And the wallpaper.
Yeah. Just there's something about that MFI chintz sort of meltdown in there of that early 90s kitchen hasn't been done. Things like that really beautiful.
Yeah, it was quite kind of eerie, kind of thinking,
completely
packed
at the time. Yeah, loads of kitchens haven't been in.
What I loved about it was the fact that it is, you know, it's truthful about teenage friendship in that, like, they're mates, but they're not, you know, there for you through thick and thin.
It's not BFF, is it?
No, it's not hugs and learnings. They all kind of hate each other.
Read
and they all drop each other in it at the drop of a hat. Yes. They all betray each other for anything at all.
Yeah. Teenage girls.
Well, I mean, I'm not, you know, my knowledge of teenage girls is pretty out of date now, but I'm going to ask you to. But it did, to me, it really captured the mad boredom of being a teenager. Yeah. And the fact that you're in the middle of a sectarian civil war is almost incidental.
It's brilliant.
Like, it shows that, you know, every crisis is 90% boredom for the people involved in it. Mm. And, you know...
Inconvenience
and tedious and so on. The girls themselves are fantastic. And the performances are brilliant, particularly Erin, Saoirse Monica Jackson's Erin, like the kind of, insofar as there's a central character, it's her.
Yeah.
And it's a really, to me, it's a really adult performance. It's like... ludicrously sitcom expressive, kind of over the top, but really, really well.
Yeah,
works.
Her facial expressions are brilliant.
But actually, that is, in my limited experience of teenage girls, that's what teenage girls are like. Yeah. They are over the top. Everything's a big deal. Everything's a mega deal. Yeah. I've got to say, though, that Michelle, bad influence Michelle, really eerily reminded me of like a 15-year-old female version of Michael Smiley. Very much so, even down to the raven.
That's giving her a lot of darkness, isn't it?
She's got a lot of darkness. Yeah. Well, the bit when she's raving in the... She goes upstairs in the chip shop that they're supposed to be cleaning and just digs out the rave tapes and the brandy and is having her own rave on a, on a Saturday morning.
I knew so many girls like that.
But it's very Michael Smiley as well.
It's amazing. But to see girls portrayed in that way, in what I would think is a normal way, it's just wonderful.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then it's not done with any heavy-handedness at all. It's really joyful. The whole thing really uplifting.
Well, there's a as in all good things, the key explanatory line is in the first 10 minutes, and it's when one of the girls, they're supposed to be not wearing uniform to school, and they've all been made to wear uniform by their mum and dad, apart from one girl who says, "Well, I'm not being individual on my own." But also a bit sad as well, the fact, you know, you see on the wall in the first few moments of this a gigantic Dolores Cranberry poster.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously this was shot last year, but it's kind of that sort of.
I watched it just that evening after the news broke, and it was just like, oh, you know.
Yeah. So, is this what female friendship is like?
Yeah.
For us clueless men.
But it did take me back to, you know, the horrible days when I was like 12 or 13, and we'd all call each other to check what colour jeans we were going to wear to go to the Quadrant Centre in Swansea on the bus.
Or wear your own clothes day. Oh, yeah. And no one could sit down in my school because our jeans were so tight. You know, you sit down for assembly. Yeah. Everyone sit down and wear your own clothes. Day. It reminds you of that.
We were not 13.
We were not allowed to wear our own clothes. We could just about get away with a two-tone badge on the inside of a lapel if you were lucky. Okay, let's have a bit more music. Sean Patton, which track have you brought in?
I have brought in the Harry Nilsson side project. Oh, this is niche.
Thanks for that.
With John Lennon.
I'm really excited.
Yes, so exciting. This is also has a link because Sean Lennon is on the Moon Landings album. Yes. John Lennon and Harry Nilsson became a dream team of alcoholic ne'er-do-wells in Los Angeles in 1974 during John Lennon's Lost Weekend period. Now, as you know, I hate the Beatles. I mean, just can't tell me that the Beatles were good. They're awful. But when John left, he was brilliant. He was, you know, and him and Yoko and stuff. He split up from Yoko and went completely mad. Harry Nilsson from Without You fame, which he did write, was going off the rails by this point. He lost his voice in the middle of the recordings. It just sounds shambolic. It sounds rock and roll in a really good way. It sounds fun. And it's also Bob Dylan and they do Bob Dylan better than Bob Dylan can do himself. Subterranean Homesick Blues.
So here we go. This is The Pussycats, or is it just Pussycats, with Subterranean Homesick Blues.
So that was Harry Nilsson and John Lennon doing Subterranean Homesick Blues off the album called Pussycats. The reason that he lost his voice halfway through it, and it's a terrible thing, is that ever since the Beatles, when they were interviewed in America during one of their tours, and they said, they were asked, who's your favourite group? Who's your favourite artist? And they said Nilsson. And they said, who's your favourite group? And they said Nilsson as well, because he was famous for multi-tracking all his stuff and doing all his own stuff. Harry Nilsson was obsessed with the Beatles and had done loads of kind of pastiches and stuff, and really and had been on for about 10 years to Lennon to work with him, and Lennon had always kind of knocked it back. And then on the famous Lost Weekend, when they were drinking brandy Alexanders and sticking ladies' sanitary products to their heads in Los Angeles clubs, Lennon said, "Okay, we'll do it." However, because they were drinking so much and they were so in such a state that when Harry Nilsson started to sing, he ruptured his vocal cords.
Oh, wow.
And but was so determined.
He went through.
That he went through it. And he had famously had one of those kind of ridiculous octave ranges on his voice. And after this record, he never got it back because he destroyed it. Well, because of drinking with Lennon.
Drugs reference on the cover. I mean, you know, it's all pretty...
Is this why he chopped all those lads up and stuffed them down the drain in Crouch End? Well, I actually quite like that. And I famously can't stand John Lennon or the 70s. So I thought it was...
You love the 70s. I do like glam rock.
I just don't like. I don't like. Like I don't like classic rock. And
it's not classic rock.
I know that's
this
why I like it. That's why I like it. Is this Pussycats album, apart from that track, is it terrible?
No, it's not that bad. I think it's really
plodding. It's the one where they've basically got all their mates on it. So Klaus Voormann plays bass on it. Ringo Starr drums on it. There's a version of Many Rivers to Cross which should be taken out and shot, which is the complete antithesis of the classic kind of reggae version. I think it's an interesting artifact, but I don't rate it in his oeuvre.
So it basically is the moon landings then. Yes. It's deliberate shambles for your entertainment. Okay, well, it's pretty much another show in the bag. The time is ticking down, and it means it's time for closing time chatter, where our guests let us know what they'll be nattering about as the towers go up in whichever gin palace they'll be frequenting at the weekend. Jude Rogers, your closing time chatter.
I was thinking, as Netflix jumped the shark, I hate that phrase actually, jumped the shark. Stupid phrase. I know it's from the Fonz something, isn't it? I live on a hill in a remote valley in the mists, and we don't have any takeaways. We can't deliver to our house, so we basically just eat cheese and watch Netflix. That's what Dan and I do.
Netflix and cheese.
Netflix and cheese. The life of a 39-year-old woman. But yeah, just there's so much has gone on to Netflix recently. Obviously, they've had lots of success. They've put some fantastic stuff. I enjoyed Stranger Things. I've enjoyed loads of their stuff. But quite a few things I've watched recently just feels like there's so much money swilling around that some things are just a bit ridiculous. There is a Jerry Seinfeld series, Comedians in Cars with Coffee, that was on YouTube for a while, which was funny, quite lo-fi. He'd get, Larry David in the car and they just, chat for like 20 minutes and it was funny, and now it's turned into this really flashy like Top Gear with A-list comedians kind of thing. He's in this ridiculous jacket, they're driving a stupid Ferrari, he's there with Jim Carrey.
Is it a bit self-congratulatory?
It's not a bit self-congratulatory. It's ridiculously so. I haven't seen the film Bright that came out before Christmas, but that's had fairly poor ratings, and it just feels like every second there's something new being put on there, and I wonder if the quality control is slipping a bit. I watched the Jim Carrey, this Jim Carrey documentary as well.
That's great.
Yeah,
the Andy Kaufman one.
But yes, lots of it I liked, but towards the end of it I thought, this is basically Jim Carrey kind of trying to rebrand himself.
But
to
it's
kind
a
of...
separate documentary. I think Netflix bought it. I don't think it was.
Oh, was
Netflix.
It? Okay, they didn't develop it.
And also, Jim and Andy, The Great Beyond.
It is really good. But I did feel like towards the end, he's using it as a vehicle to kind of get himself back out there because he hasn't had major roles recently. I felt he was slightly cynical.
And also, there's a thing which has just launched called, which is the new David Letterman series. And it's a monthly in-depth interview. And the first one interviews Barack Obama. And it's just, it's fantastic. It's really fantastic.
Just do that stuff and don't do Comedians in Cars with Coffee. That's basically like money. I love Seinfeld.
When something reaches the size that Netflix has, it has its own momentum and its own appetite. And they've got, the idea that, they dipped their toes into original programming a few years ago and it worked brilliantly well because they were able to choose carefully and actually had limited resources, so had to make very serious choices about what they were doing. Now they've moved into behavioural mapping, they've moved into the psychology of viewers, but more than anything, they've got to put a lot of stuff out.
But there's so much every week, people can't keep up with it. I think Netflix has been fantastic because it's really up the ante with the kind of quality of programming, I think. But they reached their peak about 3 or 4 months ago. Now, I'm a bit sad, there's a slow decline, and I'll have to start watching, iPlayer.
Sean Pattenden, what's your closing time chatter for this
week?
Well,
I'm very excited about Duncan Jones Book Club. Yay!
Oh, yeah.
Duncan Jones, as we know, is David Bowie's son. And David Bowie had a long list, 100 book titles that were published in various things over the last 10 years. They're actually mainly 80s, 90s books anyway. And Duncan Jones is going to do a Twitter book club. So we, if you're in it, have all got to read Hawksmoor by Peter Aykroyd, which is a rollicking affair about the devil mainly, and Spitalfields and Hawksmoor, who built the big church.
When's the deadline for it? Because I want
February
to do this.
February the 1st.
Oh, okay.
Now, what's happened is Hawksmoor, the book, has sold out of many, many establishments.
Oh,
so
really?
It's going for £2,000 on their books. I mean, just the crappy little paperback copy.
Is it not in print?
It is in print, but there was a big run on them. Because, obviously Duncan Jones didn't ring up Penguin and say, oh, I'm going to do a book club and you better get some copies in. He just decided to do it at the end of last year.
Well, this list is widely available, so publishers should be getting their fingers out. Yeah, and yeah. Publishing
also,
everything else on the list.
I've become one of, as you get older, I just, going into the library going, excuse me, do you think you should be doing Duncan Jones Book Club? Do you think you should have a big display? Why don't I help you? Why can't I do a book? You know, and why aren't people sort of jumping on the bandwagon? Why isn't Peter Ackroyd's Hawksmoor on the big table in every Waterstones and every other bookshop?
Because they've all been sold, that's
country.
Why.
Well, they're coming into print. They are available, so you can get more of them. You don't have to go to A Books and pay.
It's a great book already. It's great.
I read it a long time ago. A bit turgid in points now.
Oh, really?
I think. And it's nice to revisit it and go a bit psychogeographical like. And obviously, going, what I was looking forward to on the list, obviously, there's Jack Kerouac, there's Don DeLeo, there's Jim Capote, but also David Bowie put Camille Paglia's Sexual Persona.
Oh, big
which
fan
I
of that.
Can we do that? That'd
big
be great,
that,
Duncan.
Yeah.
So, Duncan, I'm with you. Let's do this and let's make this
he's
big.
Great, isn't he?
Isn't he lovely?
I'm a bit in love with him. Do you know he mainly the best thing him. That ever happened in yeah. my career, she says, with quote, on career is I wrote a piece about how Bowie got involved with the making of The Snowman and I found out
speaking
to lots of people who were involved in it that one of the animators had made a scarf for Bowie to wear that day but she didn't know what had happened to it, but she thinks he'd gave it to his son. So I published this piece went up, it got shared loads on Twitter, which was great, and he posted a picture of the scarf that he still has.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, Duncan Jones read my piece, you know. But he's an amazing film director as well. I think he's wonderful and obviously so lovely and down to earth and sorted.
My favourite Duncan Jones fact is that he and the Dame used to read 2000 AD together.
Oh,
that's what we
David
want.
David Bowie was your dad. Oh, I'm just going to cry again. Oh.
Right,
he was all our dads, though. He actually
was. Yeah, he was.
Yeah, all right, calm down. Right, Matt, rescue us from this sob in, this Bowie-related weep-a-thon.
I will do that. I will see Sian's psychogeography book and raise it. I've got another hat that I wear is as a producer of a podcast called Backlisted, which is a books podcast, which Andy Miller, who's a friend of Big Mouth, co-presents. And the idea is that we talk about books that are backlisted, which is a publishing term for not freshly in print. And one of the books that we did kind of a couple of years ago was this incredible book called All the Devils Are Here by a guy called David Seabrook. Yeah. And it's a kind of psychogeographic, if you like, discussion of the Medway Towns, which is where Seabrook came from, and it's seedy, and it has got Charles Hawtrey in it, and it has got it's got Lord Beaverbrook, it's got Nazi spies, it's just fantastic, and it is a book that once you have read it, you will go carry it the thoughts of it for the rest of your days, I can guarantee. And it was out of print, and we did it on this books on Backlisted, and we don't have it's not a huge podcast. But it, as you say, it then the price of it went up on A Books and Amazon, whatever. And rather brilliantly, it's just been republished by Granta Books after the kind of swell of interest after
Amazon
the podcast.
That,
and it is a book which I would recommend to everybody because it is it still kind of gives me shivers when I think about it.
I know you want to, Matt. Read out Andy Miller's tweet about this picture of each edition of All the Devils Are Here. What has he said?
He said, all the devils are here, And he's got three copies of the book on his picture.
There you go. I'm going to make it a full-on books week because my closing time chatter is that my favourite factual book is going to be Radio 4's Book of the Week next week. In Europe by Geert Mak. He's Dutch. It will be on at 9:45 every day next week. It is a fantastic travelogue.
Oh, I read this.
Yes.
It came out about years ago. And
came out years ago. Well, when
5 or 6 years ago.
When you and I worked on the Word magazine, I kept pressing it on everybody saying, you need to read this. It's an amazing
travelogue. It's like a brick, but it's amazing. Yeah.
It's an amazing travelogue of Europe at the end of the 20th century. Geert Mak travels to every country in the European Union and he tells the history of that place. He manages to tell the history of Europe as a travelogue. He manages to turn a travelogue into a personal history. You discover more about Europe in this one book than I think any of us has been taught about it either in school or by the popular media in my lifetime. It's absolutely incredible. God knows how they're going to turn into 5-15 minute chunks, but that will be a mere taster. But I exhort you to listen to it on Radio 4's Book of the Week and then buy the thing.
So has it been revised or kind of why is it?
Don't know. I mean, presumably it's just. Well, I guess they're just thinking Europe's so hot right now because we're leaving it. But we're going to talk about it on our sister podcast, Romaniacs, next week, which is of course the Brexit podcast. Other podcasts about Brexit are available, but ours is the best.
Nowhere near as good.
Yeah, but we're going to be talking about In Europe on Romaniacs next week. But I would just recommend it because it is, you know, this cliche of eye opener. It shows you what's been on our doorstep for hundreds of years, and we know so little about it, even as we've just made this enormous foolish decision to turn our backs on it. And you read In Europe and you realise what an amazing universe this place is and how little we understand it. So that's In Europe by Hayden Mack. I recommend it to everybody. And I think that's the show. So thank you to our guests, Jude Rogers, thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
And thank you to our other guest, Sean Patton, thank you for coming in. remember, dear listener, if you enjoyed this show, then you can enjoy our past episodes at audioboom.com/channel/bigmouth. There you can hear such delights as Sally Hughes and Michael Hogan on The Queen is Dead, Laura Snape's Michael Hann and Andy Miller on Björk and Noel Gallagher, and a whole lot more. And if you have a moment, go on Apple Podcasts and give us a star rating and a nice review to help us spread the word. We'll be back next week with more high-end pop talk and probably low-end pop talk as well. Until then, from me, Jude, Sean and Matt, goodbye and good luck.